Hey everybody, welcome to Live From My Drum Room. My guest today is Nashville session and touring drummer Keo Stroud. And in this episode, Keo and I talk about what it takes to be a working drummer in Nashville. And as you'll soon see, I think a lot of it has to do with his positive attitude. He's just a great guy, besides being a great drummer, but just a great guy to be around. And I think that goes a long way. We're going to play a couple of tracks that he played on, some Keb Mo tracks. Come along for the ride. Enjoy the show, and I'll see you on the other side. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. So it's a real pleasure and an honor to welcome Keo Stroud.
This is like awesome.
Oh, well, it's awesome for me. I appreciate you being here today. Yeah. You were on a panel discussion, not the last PASIC, but the one in 2022.
24, right? Yeah.
And I loved your message. I loved your positive vibes, your positive attitude about music and being a drummer and life. And
oh, thanks, man. Yeah, I like to be positive. I figure it's, you know, why waste your time on not being that? People do it, but yeah. I think it's great to try to focus on the good things, because I feel like good things bring more good things, even if, you know, something weird happens in between that. Yeah, there's still, you know, the outcome is good. So,
no, I agree. And what you say, it's so simple, right? It's so obvious and simple. But I think, you know, I find myself sometimes I get hung up on stuff, you know, and I just found, like, just hearing you talk about, like, your working in Nashville. And I know it's not easy to move to Nashville and break into that scene and get work and all that. But being around you, I could see why you've been able to do that, because besides being a great drummer, and that's obviously a big part of it, but you got to have the right attitude. You got to be around, people want to be around somebody that's positive, you know?
Oh, totally. Yeah. No, that's like the key to it. You know, it's like when you're, you know, it's weird to say coworkers, but, you know, it's essentially that's what we are. You know, when we join bands, or if you're in a session, or even if you're doing clinics, between artists and endorsers, you know, and all that stuff, you know, we're all coworkers. So we all have to get along with each other.
Yeah.
And so it's like, why not be the person that you want other people to be? You know what I mean? Where it's like, why not be easy? Why not try to be on top of your, you know, on top of your stuff? Like, why not spread good messages? You know, like, why not randomly Venmo people for coffee, you know, in the morning or whatever? You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, because like those things go far, because people remember that, you know, they remember that you're, you know, a nice person first, and then that you play great. And then they go, man, you know what? I want to be around this person.
Yeah.
And if they're like, you know, it can be like, man, that person plays great. I don't want to be around them, so I'm not calling them for this. Like, I never want to have that happen when someone says, I can't call Keo for this because I don't want to be around him, or I don't feel comfortable with him around the artist, or I don't feel comfortable with him around the secretary, or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I would like to say, if I don't get a gig, it's because someone says, man, I would have called you for that gig, but it was a metal gig. And I go, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? As opposed to, I don't do nice. I can't do nice, so don't call me. You know?
Yeah, no, I know. And and again, it's, man, we got some great folks watching, by the way, Keo. We got Harry McCarthy, Eric Lederman.
Hello, Harry.
Eric, I mean, the busiest man in show business is taking time out of his day to watch us today. So thank you, Eric. And Harry.
Yeah, I love Eric. Eric was great. I got to do Seth Meyers, and he was awesome.
Yeah.
He was so much fun. We had way too much fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I got that impression from him. He's fun to be around. But again, you know, all the pros that I know, you know, by and large, say what you say. And I just think it's important to keep reiterating that message to, like, young drummers that are, you know, I'm sure they come up to you and say, hey man, I'm thinking of moving to Nashville. What does it take to like break into the scene there? And I think you and me and other people can't remind people enough of that's such a big part of it. Like, to be a good, positive person to be around, a good hang, you know?
Oh yeah. Well, and not only that, but like, know your business and know the business. Yeah. Like, if you don't know something, ask questions about it. You know what I mean? So it's like the last thing anybody ever wants to do is hire someone who's not cool, who knows nothing about the business, because everything they end up coming out to be kind of ignorant, you know, which is like a lovely word that people hate to use these days. But it's a real thing where you're like, you're just, mm-hmm. you're oblivious, you're ignorant to what you need to do to yourself and to other things. So nobody wants that. You know, you want a nice person who is willing to learn about the business, no matter what it takes, within reason, obviously, no matter what it takes to do that, and then grow with it and be able to, you know, ebb and flow and change. You know, it's like I see guys like Eddie Bears who's have, you know, Eddie's had like a, you know, 300-year career, and he's still getting called, you know what I mean? like people still want to call, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know, at 70, I forget how old he told me he was the other day, but at 70 something years old, he is still playing on records. He's still doing his things. Why? Because he's a nice guy. He plays great and he knows the business. So when he's in him or anyone else that when they're, you know, when they know how to play the game, or they know how to, I guess game is not the correct word, but maybe it is, but they know how to play the game and know how to keep working. And you can learn from those guys. And that's the other thing too, is like about being in Nashville, is that everybody is so accessible, especially nowadays. You can literally FaceTime, you know, not FaceTime, you can send a message on Facebook to your favorite drummer in Nashville, and they will probably respond to you in a positive way. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you can get together and you can hang out with that person, and you guys can talk about drums, you can talk about children, you can talk about your wives, you can talk about your parents, whatever. But you have that ability to do that. And so people should really take advantage of that. And then also when you do that, know that someone has given their time to you. So like, don't ruin that time, because that might be the only time you ever get to hang out with that person. Because they might be, the next time you call them, they might be like, yeah, nah, buddy, you just talked about yourself the whole time, you know, or you tried to tell me, or you tried to, yeah. you know, like, cause yeah. like some people, I've had this before where people were like, hey man, like, I'm in Nashville, and people said, I need to meet you. Rich Redman said, I need to meet Keo Stroud. And I'm like, ah, sure, man, whatever. You know, and then they meet you and they go and they want to talk to you about stuff. But then as they're talking to you, they ask you questions, but then they answer the question to let you know that they know the answer to it, which is then a waste of my time.
Yeah.
Because I'm not there for you to prove, you know, you're not, we didn't get together so that you can prove to me that you know everything. You got there because you want me, you had questions for me about what to do. And then if I answer the question the way you think I'm going to answer it, then that means you're on the right path. You know what I mean? And people don't understand that sometimes, you know,
yeah.
where like, you know, yeah.
That, no, that's what you're saying is huge. And that's, I think, that's like a communication thing. You're right there. What you just is a great example of like in many instances too, right? I mean, it could be, I've had that happen where, exactly. And maybe I'm doing it right now by talking about me, which I don't mean to do, but I totally know what you mean though, where you're like, you're kind of thinking, man, I'm happy to be here and give you my time and my insights and information and stuff I've dealt with since I've been here, but you're just like talking over me right now. And like, what's the point?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
No, man. I mean, actually a great experience that I had where experience where you should listen to people when they're talking to you. So when I got the chance to do, when Eric contacted me about doing the Seth Meyers thing, I was all about it. And he was like, man, you're going to get a bunch of information thrown at you, so just respond, you know, as quickly as possible and blah, blah, blah. You know, I was like, oh, of course, you know, and I'm like, and I'm, you know, there's a million emails and the whole thing is all these great things that happen. But the most important thing is for you to absorb this information they're giving you. Mm-hmm. And if you have questions, you ask a question, then you get an answer so that you don't screw up. And it's one of the situations where like you go into, especially, you know, like it's like, I'm a drummer, I play drums, woohoo, right? But then you go into a situation when you have a band leader, you have producers, you have people around and say, hey, man, so this is what we need. We need you to. And when they said to me, we need you to do these things, I said, OK, yes. OK, yeah. And I do this on what now again? OK, that. OK, cool. Yes. Proper response. Yeah. The response wasn't, so we need you to, man, I've done TV before. We do the local thing, you know. I know. Yeah, 3-4-1-2. Man, I count it off. You know what I mean? Like, and which is exactly what you don't do on that show. But you know what I mean. But it's like, that's an example of being a good listener, you know, and I think I did a good job because Eric hasn't punched me yet. So, but you know, it's like, you know, being that's part of being a good, you know, of being successful. Cause I can strangely say that now that I feel like I am now successful. For many years, I didn't feel that I was, because I didn't have certain things. I didn't own, you know, a Ferrari or a million-dollar home, which I guess maybe close now, but no. But I didn't own those things. but you know, I've been in Nashville for almost 24 years, and I haven't had a day job. You know, I built cases once with a buddy of mine who was awesome, and that was talking about a lesson in listening. That's one right there. Building road cases is really hard. That's really, really hard. So
yeah.
Shout out to Rodney Edmondson for teaching me how to build road cases.
Yeah, Rodney. So big shout out to Rodney. Yeah, yeah. Love Rodney.
Yeah. He literally went to work with him at Spectrum and learn how to build cases. And he was very, 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 very polite with me. So it was really good. I think he even fired me, but I can't remember if he did or not. If I just quit.
You went on the road with somebody, so then he fired you.
You know what I mean? But it's like, we're talking about, you know, being a good listener and all those things. And one of the things you should listen to is yourself. And it's something that I've done a very bad job of doing throughout most of my life because I've been a fairly, you know, I should probably lay on the couch for this one. I've been a fairly insecure man in my life. as a musician in Nashville, one of the things that's crazy is that you have all these great players, and it's so hard to not compare your shortcomings to someone else's success, right? Which is crazy to say it because you don't want to, you say, man, why don't I have this? Why don't I have this? And why does this person have this? I want that. And then you go, well, this person did this and the other. What did you do? Okay, you did most of that. What was your attitude like? Oh, so your attitude wasn't right. That's why this person is doing this or you're not. Or simply, this person met that person first. Yeah. I know you know the same people, but they met that person first.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But one of the things you have to do is you have to listen to yourself and say, just because I don't have the biggest gig in the world, or I'm not on the new whatever record that just came out that everybody's raving about, that doesn't mean that you're not successful. That just means you didn't do that. You know, that's just one thing. That's just one of many things that could be considered successful. So, like, just breathing, one, is being successful. And then, two, just having it, you know, being able to make music, even if it's not your full-time job, if you have a part-time job to help supplement music, you're still doing it. And if you're playing in Nashville, if you're playing in New York, if you're playing in places where you're making money, then you're technically a professional. So you are being, you know, and if you are doing that and that's what you want to do, then you are successful. And you have to go, well, I am successful. I may not have this. I may not have done that. But in my path that I'm going right now, I'm successful. I'm happy. I should be happy. If I'm not happy, someone kick me in the face so I can be happy and let's move on.
I think that's great, man. It's perspective. Absolutely, man. So when you mentioned you've been in Nashville now 24 years and you grew up in Athens, Georgia, I think I saw, right? Which has a great music scene, or I'm sure it still does, but I'm sure it did when you were growing up. I mean, what a great place.
Oh, it was great, man. There was music everywhere. I mean, it was like, you know, there was like the rock scene, you know, like that Athens is known for like the indie rock scene. Mm. And then they has like a little underground, like local R&B scene. And then there's churches, you know, the whole thing. Growing up, our quote unquote churches were not as, they were a little more traditional as far as music goes. They weren't like your contemporary churches up north that were, you know, had full blown, like, you know, concerts going. I remember growing up playing drums with my granddad at church. My grandfather plays organ, and he would play kick bass and organ. And we would laugh because I felt like every song was a shuffle. But we'd play in church, and my lesson in listening and learning how to follow.
Great.
Was that, which is funny because like his birthday was yesterday, and I was like, man, like my granddad's actually like my biggest musical influence. Like, I, you know, like I can be like, oh, I love Steve Gadd, I love this person, the other person, but I thought about it, you know, over the course of a few hours yesterday, and I was like, man, like that, my dad's a guitar player and he's great, and I love him, you know, but like my granddad to me is like probably my biggest musical influence growing up as a kid, because he was very encouraging. And he didn't take any mess, so I couldn't speed up or slow down. He'd yell at me. So that was another one. But the cool thing about being in Athens is that you had that, and then you could go downtown and you would have your, I mean, when I was a kid, REM was just, they were starting to do a thing. B-52s, there were a couple other bands, you know, Watchbird Panic, Randall Bramlett was another one. There were a bunch of like kind of like soul R&B guys, I guess they would call it blue eyed soul kind of thing that was happening. And then there were two great music stores as a kid. I guess three, actually. There was Chick, Piano, Musicians Warehouse, and Nude Sound. And I used to go hang out at those places every day and bother the shit out of people. and all that stuff. But I met a lot of older musicians that were playing, and then my dad's a musician, so he knew some guys. So I was kind of sort of in that thing of like wanting to check it all out. So I didn't want to just be a church drummer. You know, I wanted to kind of do a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was one of the beautiful things about Athens, is that there is a touch of everything there. And then personality wise, there's a touch of everything there. Like there, you know, you have everything from college students to old people that have been there forever, to business people, to hippies, to like, assholes, whatever, you know.
Yeah,
everybody's like
the gamut, you know? Yeah.
And you know, and you, and they all, you know, and so, and there's a little tiny little music scene slash business there, and so you get to meet those people, and then what happens is you move to Nashville, you just get that times 10 in intensity and in people.
Yeah,
you know, it's like all of a sudden your little NBA just went from, you know, 20 bands to like 2,000 musicians all wanting the same gig.
So. Exactly. And so when did you, how old were you when you started playing drums? And was drums your first instrument?
So drums were technically my, well, I guess, yeah, I mean, they are my first, yeah, it's my first instrument. Yeah. I was about three or four the first time I started to play. And then I was about five or six, my dad taught me how to play guitar. I had forgotten everything about playing guitar completely. I own one. thanks to Johnny Rabb. Johnny Rabb bought me a guitar for Christmas one
year. I love Johnny Rabb.
Randomly, it was great. So
that's great.
So I started playing drums. It's three or four, and obviously, like my folks saw that I could keep time, and I was willing to move the drums around. As a kid, I've always been a tinkerer. I always like to mess with stuff, and so I was always taking drums apart and putting them back together and destroying them, and my dad's like, you know, you gotta buy another drum. But I see, you know, what's really funny is, I think it's still here somewhere. Oh, it's right here. So check this out. This is, if I can reach it. This is the first snare drum my dad bought me.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. I've modded it. It's a Pearl
Jupiter?
From over steel. It's technically not a Jupiter because it's not the super sensitive thing, but basically it's a Jupiter.
Okay. Yeah.
And, but yeah, so I've the same shell. I've had this drum for 40 years.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah. So it's pretty funny. It still has like stupid stickers on it. But, that's what's funny is that's snare drum number one. So I consider that my snare drum sound if I have one, you know.
Yeah.
I have a snare drum sound. But if I could, you know, if I have to say a snare drum sound, that is the drum. But so anyway, so I still have that from my childhood. So I've brought a bit of Athens, Georgia to Nashville with me. And so it's been kind of cool. So
that's awesome, Q. That was my next question, was like, do you ever use the drum? And for it to be your number one drum is pretty, that's awesome, man. Just to
yeah, yeah. No, it's cool. It's great. It's Yeah, it's been a few. It's been a few records and a bunch of tours and some. There was a period of time where I didn't use it because I was playing a deeper snare drum, but I forget what that was or why I was doing that. But there was a time where I went to a 6.5, which is actually really funny. So 2 seconds. Sorry, I'm detouring this whole thing, but
not at all. This is
so. In the eyes of matching snare drums, I have the 6.5 version, but this is actually the brass one.
Okay.
And Eddie Bears gave me the snare drum like 3 weeks ago.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. He knew how much I liked the Jupiters and how much I liked the 70s Pearl snare drums. And he was like, "Hey man, I have this. Do you want it?"
So, Eddie is just, man. What an incredible human.
Yeah, man, he's on another level, man. So, and what's funny is, so we're talking about me throwing drums, talking about being in Nashville. I met Eddie early on, and he was one of the nicest guys to me. And kind of like, I wouldn't say like he's my mentor, but like, because he's everybody's mentor, you know, but he was super, super kind in helping me get established and telling me where to go and who to meet and then putting in a good word with people like, oh yeah, hire him. He's great. So, or he's good, whatever, you know? So.
Yeah, that's, I love that, you know, and I know that about Eddie and I've heard that about other really established guys in town that aren't, you know, it's not like a cutthroat situation where they feel threatened by a new guy coming into town. And it's like, you know, I just think it's beautiful. It's wonderful that Eddie did that.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, what I say about Nashville is that it's a community, not a competition. And so what happens is you come to this place and then you kind of like, you know, you bop around, you ping pong around, and then something sticks and then you find your people. And then your people for either 2 days or 20 years. You know what I mean? And then you bop around some more and then you find more people and you bop around, you know, and the whole, and you find that a bunch of people aren't from here. So it's a bunch of people looking for a musical home and like a home with inside, you know what I mean? Where you're trying to establish who you are. And I keep dropping people's names in this because it's things I've learned from people on the way, but one of the things that Ben Caesar said was that you should establish your quality of life first and then pursue your dreams. Because if not, if there's no foundation there, then you're just going to be broken. You know, you're going to take certain things really hard that may not be hard, or you're not going to understand certain things when you should understand them if you don't have a core that's away from music. You know what I mean? Just knowing you deep inside kind of thing. We're not getting so like deep inside, but you know what I mean?
So that makes a lot of sense. And when you moved to Nashville, did you go there with kind of a wide open slate in terms of like, were you going there to be like a session guy, a touring guy, or just to get there and just get into the scene? Or did you have like a plan?
So yeah, this is where things get kind of funny and weird, right? So I moved to Nashville, and I'd always heard the stories about how everybody's so great here, and how like the guy at Waffle House cooking is a better drummer than you'll ever be. How the you know all these stories, and they are true. You know what I mean? And so my whole thing was like, well, I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough to play music in Nashville, but you know, we'll see what happens. And the way this story goes, the legend goes, is such this. So basically, my dad's buddy had a band in Nashville. They came to play Athens. The drummer didn't show up for whatever reason. So I played drums. And so after the gig, the band leader says, "Hey man, you want to move to Nashville?" I said, "Yeah, I do." And so I talked to my dad about it. And he said, and so because it's a cover band, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm 20 years old and I'm like, cover band. And my dad just goes, "Well, you know, you like music, so you should do it." I said, "Yeah, well, what I'll do is I can play in this cover band until I get a gig as a roadie. Because I loved, you know, like I like to mess with drums. So yeah. I was like, well, I'll play this cover band until I get a gig as a drum tech. Because that was my goal at the time. Because I was like, I don't want to go there thinking I'm some hotshot drummer, get, you know, and just realize I'm not, get discouraged, whatever. So I love working on drums. So let me do that. So anyway, so I moved to Nashville. I'm playing in his cover band, and I'm meeting a bunch of people. My buddy Lee Kelly. I knew JD Blair. I knew JD Blair and Victor Wooten before I moved, because I randomly ran into them at a concert and just kind of hounded JD into being a friend, and he was very kind, and we became buddies. So I knew him, and then I just kind of slowly started to just go out every night to meet people, and then. After about a year in town of not being a drum tech still, I got a call from JD Blair and said, hey man, you want to tech for two shows with Shania? And I was like, yes, I've made it. This is going to be great. Like, I'm going to do these two. The crew chief is going to see me and he's going to be like, Keo, you're going to be drum tech to the stars. Right. So it was two TV shows and I did a great job, I think. No one yelled at me, but no one also ever hired me again as a drum tech. but I had high hopes. You know, it was really great. But so what ended up happening is I played in that cover band for about a year and a half. And then I started to play on Lower Broadway and then in the Printer's Alley. And then this guy, Dave McAfee, saw me playing at Printer's Alley and was like, hey, man. I know this guy putting together a band. I used to play for him back in the 90s. He's kind of been doing a new thing. I think he'd be perfect for it. I was like, okay. So I ended up playing with this guy, Wade Hayes. And that was my first like country artist gig. And I was like, all right. So it's like 2002. And I'm like, okay, well, all right. No one's yelled at me. I've been fired from this. This is cool. All right. Fire me good. And so then the year ends, you know, and then the next year, Wade doesn't really go out. And I was like, okay, well, I'm playing down on Broadway and living was cheap. It was just me. All right. We're good. You know, blah, 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 blah. And then like I end up getting these random gigs throughout the year with like this guy, Mark McGuinn, and several other people through that year. And I was like, oh, this is how you do it. You piece things together.
Yeah. That's so funny.
You know, like, oh, you just, you know, like I don't have the Kenny Chesney gig. I don't have a huge gig. So my deal is I have to piece things together to make a year. Oh, okay. I get it. And so in doing that I did that for a few years until I got the Rodney Crowell gig, which is like 2004, 2005. And I did that gig off and on for about 10 years. And then I went back to, then I just started doing just random stuff again of piecing it together, blah, 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 blah. And in 2014 was like kind of a weird, crazy year which is when I started playing with Big and Rich, which lasted for about 8 years. I just recently left that gig about a year and a half ago to focus on playing mostly in town and doing sessions. But that's kind of a long a short roundabout of my life. But in between all of that, there's this long list of people I got to play with.
Yeah, it's great.
While piecing together those years, I kind of became a big sub guy. I was, you know, if your drummer couldn't make it, then I was like the Mikey of gigs. It's like, call Keo, he'll do it. You know, and I would learn 24 songs in 60 minutes and go play them. So
I wanted to get to that because I remember you talking about that. You know, like that's incredible. Like that you've become this reliable go-to guy is what it is. And I'm just cracking up at your story because, you know, like the idea, I totally get it. Like you were thinking you wanted a job as a drum tech for, some amount of stability of like, you know, I'm going to go out on tour for 3 months or 6 months and I'll get a good steady paycheck. But meanwhile, you're like getting all these gigs because you're a freaking great drummer. You know, it's pretty comical. You know what I mean? It's like, man, I keep getting I keep getting calls to do these gigs when I'm waiting for that drum tech call to come in, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was true, man. I was just like, well, okay, well. And you know, I love to absorb information. You can talk to any of my friends, or it's like Keo knows way too much stuff about nothing. Like it's just stupid things that people shouldn't know. This guy knows, including songs, because I've learned so many. So it's like you could call like some strange like Vern Gosden song. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I know that one. And somebody's like, who the hell's Vern Gosden? You know what I mean? Or, you know, it'd be like some like weird Wilson Pickett song, you know? So I love information. So I guess I'm an information junkie. So, when people would be like, hey man, here's 16 songs. Can you go play tomorrow? I was like, yeah, no problem.
Wow.
And I would, you know, it's a true story. And it's just 87% correct. I would be 87%, which is passing. Yeah. And then there were some, you know, and then there were some gigs where, you know, it depends on, you know, how, it depends on what I got. And there's certain things you miss because board tapes don't show like visual cues. Mm-hmm. Which is a funny one I had a few years ago. I was out with someone and they were great. I got to sub with Cody Johnson, and I've known those guys for a long time, and it was so fun. And you know, I came out no rehearsal, but they gave me the board tapes, they gave me charts, everything, and it's great. But the one thing that we kind of sort of didn't think about was that, you know, like Cody cued some certain things that you, so I can't see them.
Yeah.
You know, so like, you know, on a board tape, you can't see it. So I remember we were going through a song at soundcheck and I came in early for something. And they were like, oh, Cody will cue that. And I was like, oh shit. Okay, cool. Okay. So then you just go, okay, yeah. Cody cues, you know, and what was really cool. And this is one of the cool things I like about that guy and working with Cody and the band and the whole organization is that after soundcheck, we sat down and we listened to the board tape and he just kind of gave me his cues of what he was doing during the show. Like, hey man, like I typically want to do this here, or I start this here, or I cue a downbeat here, or blah, blah, blah. And it's cool because a lot of artists, especially at his level, would never sit down with a drummer and be like, hey man. And not like a mean, like it wasn't like I had like a sit down. It wasn't like you haven't done your homework, son. No, take this beat. And it wasn't that. It was like, hey man, like you want to win. I want to win. If you're cool with it, let's just go over this. And I was like, absolutely. He was like, oh, cool. And we did. And we, you know, we didn't sit there for the whole 90 minutes, but you know, there were certain songs. He was like, hey man, on this, I like to do that. Or you'll see, you know, the key for this is that. And it was cool because, and it wasn't like I didn't get like 90% of the information from the drummer. I did, but there was just that little 10% of things that were kind of important that, you know, he does it every day. So he didn't think about it, you know, kind of thing. But once again, I sat there, I shut my mouth and I listened, you know, even things I knew, I was like, oh yeah, I know that's a blah, blah, blah. I was like, yeah, and you're going to do this. And I go, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. And then we went out and played, you know, that weekend went out and played 3 flawless shows and it was great, you know? So yeah. Anyway,
no, that's great. I'll just say it's he obviously knew you could do it and he wanted to just, I think that's great because it shows that he wanted to invest a little bit of his time to just get you that 10% to make it perfect. You know what I mean? Like he could have on the other hand, just gone like, ah, man, these shows are going to be a wash. Let's just deal with it. You know? And like, if I were the drummer, he'd go, we can't help this guy. Let's just get through the weekend and deal with it. No, but he knew he could get you over the finish line a lot easier, you know, just taking that time. That says a lot. Yeah.
Right, which is cool, man, because like, you know, one of the things I always say, and I think this goes for everybody, and it goes back to being the fucking nice person, all that stuff. I just said fucking anyway, nice person, all that. But the whole thing is that my job is to provide comfort. My job as a drummer, as a human, is to provide comfort for the people that I'm around and that I'm working with. And one of the things I like to hear from people when I suffer them is that I forgot you were back there. And I go, cool. It wasn't like I forgot that you know, the drums were back there. It was like, I felt comfortable and I wasn't looking over my shoulder thinking, man, I really wish my drummer was here. I was saying, I just played the show as normal. And then when I walked off stage, I said, who is that on drums? I've never seen them before. Which has happened. I've gone on sub gig before and not met the artist until after the show. Like, it's happened.
Yeah.
I think the first time I played with Hank Jr., I met Hank the next day.
No kidding. Oh, man. So, yeah. What was that like?
I think it was the next day.
Yeah, that must have been unbelievable too. But
it was fun, man.
Yeah, you make a great point, Keo. That the idea is to just like have it be seamless and not have the artist be thinking like, man, is this new drummer gonna know to do this? He didn't have to think about it though. It was just like, yeah, that's the ideal. That's the best job you could ever do, right there.
Yeah, and you know, and also something that it doesn't work on every gig, but you know, you are you, and the other person you're subbing for is who they are. So, and it's like, it's almost like, it's going to sound kind of silly, but all right. Drummers, lead singers, right? In my opinion, those two chairs are two things that can be interchanged and the band still be the band, mm-hmm. but personalities are there. Where you feel things, where you place things are going to be there. Singers and drummers. Those are the two positions in a band that I think can severely alter and not in a bad way, but just alter the feel of a band. You know what I mean? So it's like anytime your favorite singer of rock band X goes away and they get a replacement in, people always go, they're not the same. Da, da, da. It's like, no, it's the same. It just feels different. That person's doing their interpretation of themselves and they're not doing the other person.
Yeah.
You know, like one of my favorite things is like watching Paul Rodgers with Queen. You know, Paul Rodgers is 100% Paul Rodgers with Queen.
Right.
You know, what I mean? He wasn't trying to be Freddie Mercury because he's not him.
Right.
And just in some ways, that's massive respect also, you know, and that's also being secure in who you are and doing your thing going, hey, man, I'm not him. I can't be him. I can be me. I can sing. I can perform these songs and people will love these songs. Yeah. I'm sure Paul Rodgers said, people will love these songs. I don't know. But you know what I mean? And so the same thing happens for a drummer where, you know, drum fills are the way I grew up playing drums. Drum fills are an expression, you know. So basically, the groove pattern is you trucking along, doing your thing, and then the drum fills are your expression to the next section. So it's like, oh, hey, I have to get off. You know, I got to do this, so I do a drum fill, and they're fills that are natural to you. Their feels are unnatural. There's, you know, obviously there's certain things where, you know, if you're playing like Ain't Too Proud to Beg, do the get to bang, you know, if you said black out, the black out, the ding, you know, you're like, that's not the right wrong song.
Motown, baby. Yeah.
Wrong song. But, you know, but if you're, you know, but if you're playing a tune and, you know, you're chucking along and say the record, you know, say it was like boom, bop, doom, got, doom, got, got, do, do, boom, right? And say you play it and you're subbing and you don't remember that drum feel, but you know, there's a feel there and you go, doom, got, doom, got, doom, got, do, 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 bop. Like, no one should be mad about that because you're not, you know, you're, first of all, it's close. And second of all, that's your interpretation of that feel because it's a feel. I take feeling as like not filling something up, but feeling as into the feeling into the next section, as opposed to feeling. You know, I like to say feel instead of the next section of the song, which then is where your personality comes out. You know what I mean? And you don't have to be yell at people, but you know what I mean. But you can have your subtle things. And so a lot of times when I end up subbing gigs, those things will happen. You know, like where like I may not play the drum fill going into whatever, exactly like the last guy, because one, maybe I didn't learn it. Don't tell anybody. Two, I just forgot about it. You know, it's like, I have all these other, I had these other like 25 songs that I got to remember. And I'm sorry, I don't remember that one little thing. That's not going to make or break the song. But if it's something very important, they usually stand out and you play it anyway, because, you know, it's like lyrics. It's like, oh, this, you know, it's, she's a brick house. Cool.
Yeah.
Boom. All right. I can't change the words in that. You know what I mean? So, but anyway.
Well, you this is great, man. What you're talking about is gold, and it's a perfect segue to what I want to talk about, which is some recordings that you've done with Keb Mo, which I've been so digging over the weekend. And
oh, nice.
Absolutely. It's just some beautiful work that you've done there, Keo. And I want to play, one song right now. And, this is a song called The Worst Is Yet to Come. I know you know it, and I'm guessing other people know it too. This is a great track, and I'll play the song, and then maybe we can just take a few minutes and talk about this. And I just would love to pick you, pick your brain on like how you came up with some of these ideas, and it's just chock full of great stuff. So check it out, everybody. This is Keo Stroud, Keb Mo's "The Worst Is Yet to Come," and just the title alone, I knew it was going to be a great song before I even listened to it. But it's great. Here we go. Yeah, Keo, man. Take a bow. Take a bow, brother. Wow. Really, just my pleasure. So, okay, many questions here. Who is the bass player? I meant to ask you that, first of all, who the bass player is. Do you remember?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I don't know. I think it's Keb, actually. Because So we tracked this song several times.
And so I remember
going down. Actually, that was funny. This was the first song we did on that record, and or on that album, I should say. But so initially, I played it by myself to just Kev's vocal.
Okay, that was yep.
So it was like it was just going to be like vocal, like so. The whole thing was just he was doing this record called Blues Americana, and it was going to be all acoustic, right? And then I ruined it. He basically called me and said, "Hey, I'm doing this record. Like, come over and play drums. I think it's going to be an acoustic record. So, like, basically, if you suck, it's going to be an acoustic record. But if you don't, I'm going to make a full record out of it," kind of thing, right? So I come over. I went over, and we played this song, and it was vocal. It was vocal click and resonator actually, and then drums, and so. For whatever reason, I forgot what I was listening to something, and I just sat down on the drum kit and I went, right? And he stops me and he just goes, "That's it, we're making a record." And I was like, "Okay, cool."
Wow, man.
That snare drum fill became the theme of the song.
Yeah.
But that snare drum fill is also on the record. More, it happens a few more times on the record, in certain little spots. It's so goofy though, but I think it's Kev playing bass on it. If it's not Kev, then it's, oh my God. Then it's Val, I think, if it's not Kev. I should call. Hey, Kev, who played bass on this?
It's a great bass part, man. Your drum part, that drum part is so great. And I was thinking, you've created this drum part that anybody that ever plays with Kev in the future is going to have to, like, they're going to have to play your part. You know what I mean? Like you said, that becomes a signature part of that song. That intro is, I kept replaying it, just that part, that rap, that, 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 boom. And it goes from there. It's yeah. And so, cool. So you answered the first part of that question because, so you tracked it to a click and then Keb or somebody came on and laid the bass on top of it. But it feels so great, Keo. It feels like you and the bass player are playing it together. I mean, it has that real locked kind of feel, you know?
Man, it was cool. I mean, it was, I played it was okay. If I remember correctly on this, because we played it by myself, and then they came in and played everything else on, and then I came back and replayed it. But we kept all the snare drum fills, so I just went back and played the groove. So okay. We kept all the snare drum all the snare drum fills, and then I went back and played the grooves on it. I think I remember that being the way that went down. But yeah, man, it was so much fun, and working with Kevin was so cool because. First of all, he knows what he wants, right? So, and you don't know what he wants, but he knows what he wants. So he tells you, this is what I want.
Yeah,
and you do it, right? Kind of thing. Yeah. But you do it with your intensity and your feel, which is why you're there to do it. And one of the things that he taught me that I learned and that I take with me now is that that the vocal is king. So don't cover up the money,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So drum fills, if you listen to that record, all the snare drum fills happen before he starts a vocal pickup.
Yeah.
They don't happen at the same time or they happen after.
Yeah.
And that was, he was really, really big on that. And I was very confused because, and some of the music that I've played, people want you to accent with the vocal. And he was like, stay out of the way. Right. Yeah. And I was like, all right, well, that's cool. So that was a big learning tool. Or when you do something like that, make sure that you accent and you don't cover up. So he was really big on that. And then the tom fill thing that happens in the groove, that was his idea. Because I played something and he was like, I like that. Let's do that between all the phrases. So we kind of like, it sounds strange, but we kind of like came up with like the perfect drum part.
No, you absolutely did. It's not strange. I'm glad you said that.
I mean, I know it sounds so bad to say that about yourself, but I feel like we kind of we did. By the way, the bass player is Brian Allen, who played bass on.
Okay, great. Oh, great. Thanks for
who's great bass player.
Yeah,
it's so, right. I said Tom, text. I was like, who played on that?
Those little Tom fills were overdubbed, Keo. You put those on afterward, or those were you played those?
No, I played them in the groove.
You played those.
I put them in the groove. Yeah, it was dude. Got
right in time. Yeah.
And this is what's really funny is that drum is a 10-inch tom.
Wow.
It sounds like a floor tom.
It does. It sounds much bigger. Yeah.
That on that record, it's the toms are 8, 10, and it's a 22-inch kick drum.
Tune
and the snare drum is an acro.
Yeah. And you get the 10 tune.
Everything's too low.
Yeah. Yeah. It's perfect because
the snare drum was
doesn't ring too long. Yeah.
Yeah, the snare drum was an acrolyte, I think, on that one.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So back to the drum part. No, that's great. That's all great stuff. Back to the drum part. So you didn't have he didn't play like a demo of a drum machine or something. He just like let you come up with something and go, and you came up with that intro and that set the tone really for it. I mean, that was
Well, yeah, it was weird. I mean, he said what's so crazy. It's like. To me, what's so funny, we're talking about self-confidence and being successful and all those fun things. One of the coolest things about doing this record was that it boosts my self-confidence. And I was working with this great dude who had never worked with before. I met Kev on a cruise ship. So we met on the Kaoma cruise ship where I actually sat in and played drums during his set, but it was just me and him. I was just kind of like tinkering around kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the most professional way, by the way, but tinkering around. I have like high respect for Keb, and I've known drummers that work with him before. I've heard about how he operates and very much like working with Rodney Crowell, where like those guys can hire anybody they want to. So if they call you, you're supposed to be there kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, never really working with Kevin in a studio, I didn't really know what to expect. So I just kind of went in with like this freedom of like, well, I'm just going to play this weird drum fill. And if he likes it, he likes it. If he doesn't, he doesn't. And he liked it. So there are plenty of things I did that day that he did not like. But he liked that one.
that's a good message too. Yeah, exactly. It's not always not everything that the artist is going to love, but he liked that, and that's.
Yeah.
I'm gonna play another song.
Yeah.
And this is from a different record. This is Keb Mo again. That's Who I Am, from Tajmo, and which record was the first? Like, what was The Worst Is Yet to Come? The first time
Yeah, The Worst Is Yet to Come was the first one. Yeah, that's the Blues Americana was the first record, and that was the first song that he and I ever did. Also, yeah,
great man.
Well, and this was the first song we tracked on the Tajmo record.
Great. So okay, perfect. All right. Well, I love this tune as well. Here we go. That's Who I Am. Keo Stroud on drums. Keb Mo. I'm a lover, I'm a fighter, man, that song. Can I just give you my thoughts on it? Besides,
please,
it's epic. First of all, your playing is epic. It's so, you sound so much more like confident and like seasoned, if that's even the right word. And that's why I asked which one was first. And it makes more sense that this was the later one, because you sound like, first of all, you're playing a little bit more, which is great, because all the little things you're doing are so tasty, like not overplaying at all, but just like little spots where you're putting stuff in. And I love the four on the floor and the bass drum. And then occasionally like an extra bomb, a little extra note, you know, just for accent. It's no, I mean, you know, Keo, I you sound like a session guy that's been doing it for 30 years on that song. You really you got all the right hits, all the right spots, man. Bravo.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you. I will take it. Man, that one was fun, because that was so, that was when I got the call for this one. It was like, oh yeah, Kevmo and Taj Mahal are going to do a record together. And I was like, oh, okay. All right. Whatever, you know, cool. Sounds great. And it wasn't even that. Actually, it said, I think the initial call was, hey, Kev calls, hey, what are you doing, big kid? Oh, nothing. he just goes, what are you doing tomorrow? Nothing. Man, Taj is in town. We're going to do some recording. I want you to come play drums. Okay, cool. All right. See you tomorrow, man. You know, and I show up, and it's Tommy Sims playing bass, who's fantastic.
Yeah.
And Michael Hicks is on keys. I can't remember who else played guitar other than, I think maybe Phil Hughley is on guitar on this one. And then Keb. And then Taj played resonator. And we tracked it all. I mean, it was like everybody going down kind of thing. And we had played it a couple times. And, you know, it was one of those things where it's like everybody's, we're just trying to figure it out. And I remember we were walking out, and Taj just looks at me. He just goes, hey, drama. I was like, hey, man. he goes, do your thing. Do your thing. And I was like, okay, all right. As I'm walking, I'm like, what's my thing? I have no idea. And so, you know, and it's one of those things where it's like, as soon as, you know, we count off 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, and it was just that kind of thing. And I had in my brain, I kind of had like this like dirty laundry kind of vibe thing.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking about as I was playing it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. And then as we were playing it, I was like, we're going to do it again. Cause I know how we, you know, I've made records there. I know how this works. I said, so I'm going to take some liberties. so I did. And what's really goofy is I can tell you where they all kind of came from. So if you remember in the second verse, there's a hi-hat thing and I hit the bell.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
16th note thing.
Yeah. So that's Larry London. Oh, Sherry.
Yeah, of course.
That's where that came from.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's okay.
So there's that one. And then going into the solo section, you hear bop, 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 bop with four kicks, right?
Yeah.
And that came from Love and Happiness, Al Green.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it just kicks off with the.
Yeah. Was that Al Jackson on drums? Right, Al Jackson Jr.?
Probably. I think so, yeah.
Probably,
you know, yeah. And I think that was just someone stumping on a board or something. But that's where those kind of things come from.
Yeah.
And then there was something else that I can't remember. Oh, there was the back half of the last chorus was a kind of a weird wobbly drum fill. And that happened because I got lost.
I love it. The truth comes out. I love it. It was a happy.
I mean, because I got lost. There I was in the woods with my machete. Where am I?
Oh my god. No, and so you but, do you did you and you read music then, Kia, right? I mean, you chart some of this stuff.
I do,
out?
Yeah, I can write. But this was, you know, what's goofy about this stuff is it wasn't charted. That was I didn't have a chart for this at all. If I remember correctly on this one, none of us had charts actually.
Wow,
we had there was like a chord progression thing that I think someone had chord charts. And then I had nothing. Only thing I had a blank piece of paper, and I think I wrote intro, verse. I wrote the format of the song, and that was it. But like no bars or anything. It was just like a song title, maybe, and then like the form of the tune. And so I remember when we were coming out of the solo section, I was like, okay, is this a verse or is this a bridge or is it a chorus? I can't remember. Oh, is this a, and I was like, all right. Okay, cool. You know, kind of thing. And I was like, oh, this is where I'm at. You know, I was gonna say, don't tell Kevin that, but he knows now. But it was just funny. Like, but yeah, it was, I remember like there was no charts for those. It was memory. Because a lot of times when working with Kevin over there, which is great, we'll play something 10 times. Mm-hmm. You know, he's old school and I like it, you know, because he likes to get the sounds happening and he likes to get, you know, he likes to get you going, get you warmed up and you're rocking. And I would probably take number four, I think maybe on that one. Cause we were kind of filling it out and trying to get some things happening. Yeah. But, that's probably my favorite. That's probably one of my favorite songs I've played on, like in my entire life. Like, sometimes I'll be at the grocery store and it comes on, and I'm like, "Yeah,
that's gotta feel so amazing." Yeah, that's gotta be like,
good for you, man. It's weird because like, and it's not a big pop hit or anything, but it's like, you know, it's like I wish I was Matt Chamberlain and heard myself all the time on the radio, but one day, so.
Yeah, one day, and that's. I'm so glad to hear you say that about it because you're such a humble guy. You are, and what I know of you, you're so humble, and you should feel proud of that because, man, that's like some really beautiful.
It was fun, man. It was anytime I get to work, I'll just say this, man. Like anytime you walk into a room, and you have the caliber of players of Tommy Sims, Michael Hicks, you know, Keb Moe, Taj Mahal, you know what I mean? And the engineer on that one, I think Casey was an engineer and he was another great drummer singer also, you know? So it was like, you walk into a room of greatness and you like have to like, you know, you gotta bring it. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's like being on the, you know, it's like being on the court, you know, at NBA. It's like,
yeah,
you know, you gotta bring it. No one sucks there. You can't be that guy. Can't be that guy. Just like, well, I'm happy to be here. But no, it was cool, man. It was fun because like everybody was super inspiring. It was a very like inspirational thing. And I remember like we did that one. We did like two or three songs that day. And I just remember after every take feeling good. Like I left there not knowing what it was for, and then feeling good. And then some other buddies like Marcus Finney and some other guys played on some of that record. And then I remember it coming out. And then it was like, oh, this record came out. And I was like, oh. And they're like, yeah, you're on these songs. So I was like, oh, cool.
That's pretty great.
And then Marcus did the tour and he was talking about drum fills. And he said, he goes, every night he had to go. First of all, you know, the worst yet to come is Jack, get out. But then he had to do the going into the. I thought it was dumb, but he goes, Kev loves it. And I go, actually, I secretly love that feel too. I play it all the time, but it doesn't always translate. But I'm glad at that moment it did.
Perfectly. I got to say, you mentioned Matt Chamberlain. I got to show this picture of us, our epic lunch at PASIC last year.
Yes. And everybody, and Dax,
and Dax Nielsen. Everybody watching at home, Matt Chamberlain, myself, Dax Nielsen, Keo, of course. We had this great lunch at PASIC, and then we took this group photo at the end of it, and like Matt pretended he didn't even know us. It's like Dax and Keo and I are hugging it out, you know, and there's Matt going, who are you guys again? I know you. He's not a hugger, you know. It's all right. It's all right. We love
that was Matt. A great man. That was a great time, man. Like, that was thanks for inviting me to sit down with you guys.
Absolutely. That was, yeah. I'm glad you could.
That was so much fun. And yeah, that was great. And Dax and I have been friends for years. So it was cool to catch up with him. And Matt and I have known you. I've known of Matt, obviously, my entire life since I was a child. I've known of Matt. But we have a mutual buddy in Bryson Nelson that has the Nelson Drum Shop in Nashville.
Oh, yeah. Who also love that shop
for Matt. So he kind of connected us together and was like, oh man, you guys will hit it off. You guys will have a good time. And so we hung out a couple of days, and so it was cool to kind of sit. It was nice to sit down and not have a bunch of people around, and then also no drums around for us all to like just kind of chat. You know, that was really cool. So
I enjoyed it.
And then obviously, you know, yeah, and seeing you, man. You know, I've known you for 20 plus years. So it's, you know, it's fun to, you know, to see and actually get a chance to hang out with you. You know, at all the shows, you were always so busy because you had all the dudes and you were the dude, so you were always doing your thing. But it was really nice to sit down and get to talk to you about all the crazy stuff, including the Beatles record and all that, or the Beatles song that came out and all that stuff.
That's right. We talked about that. Yeah, I remember it just being a great drummer hang, you know, just and it was so like organic, the way we were just all going, let's go get some food. Yeah, you got time? I got time. And you're like, yeah, I got time, so let's go. And it was perfect.
Yeah, it was great, man. So yeah, so thanks for that, man. That was fun.
Absolutely, Keo. And now you and Dax and Matt have been on my show, so I got all the bases covered, so I'm a happy camper.
There we go. We should like dress up as the Three Amigos for like Halloween. Me, Matt, and Dax. That'd be great.
I love it. Well, when you be at PASIC, you go every year, right, to PASIC, pretty much?
I try to go every year, man. It's my, you know, I grew up going to PASIC. That was my little fun thing that we do every year since I was like eighth grade. There was this time, there was a period where I was busy and I couldn't go, but I try to go all the time, and I love it because it's a good organization. It's actually good. It's a great organization. And it's helped. I learned so much from going to PASIC as a kid about being a professional musician, knowing how to carry myself in front of people. Sometimes I fail at that, but I do a pretty good job.
I think you do a great job.
But it was always a great education and hang, and a good way to just to meet people. Like, you know, where you can come, like sometimes people come at people for strictly for connections, and by connections in the business. And then there's time where people just hit it off and you become friends, you know, it's like, you know, like I crack up because like, you know, I met Andy Zildjian at a PASIC many, many years ago. And he's like, I say he's one of my best friends. He doesn't know that, but he's a really good, he's a good buddy.
That's great.
But you know, he's like, he's my friend and Stanky and a bunch of guys that I've met, you know, yourself and people that I've met over the years, you know, like Aaron Vistria and John Farquharson and those guys I've met over the years. And like Chad Brandolini I met when I was like 18 years old, which is like, you know, it's like,
it says something.
You know what I mean? So it's like, it's, you know, so it's like, I, you know, it was cool because I feel like growing up in that world, that's, and not that being strictly my upbringing, but growing up, going to those things, you know, like NAMM and then PASIC, I learned a lot about being in the music business. I learned about you know, Steve Ferroni, who's one of my heroes. You know, like being able to, you know, sit down, you know, and hang with Steve Ferroni or with Matt Chamberlain, you know, or with whoever, you know, that, you know, Glenn Cochi. I that's how you pronounce his name, but he was there and he was so fun. You know, like I got to sit down and like chat with him. I love that, or El Negro. So it was all these names I keep dropping. I'm just gonna be crazy in my house here, but it's like it was really, really cool to, you know, as a kid to grow up seeing those people. I remember I met Ed Thigpen when I was a young kid at PASIC, and he was so kind and very nice. I met Armand Zildjian. I met him. I met Bob. Both were hilarious. I have a great photo somewhere. I'll send it to you of me and Armin. Yeah. I'm like 18 years old And it was like PASIC in Orlando.
Oh yeah. Yeah. 98.
I have a great photo of me and him. And I have another funny one of me and Terry Bozzio. I think that's pretty goofy. Like, cause it's like, he looks terrified. He's like, who's this kid? I'm like, ah.
No, but you know, what's cool. I think what you're getting at is that, like, now you're like all these guys, you're talking about these drummers that you grew up, you know, like loving them as like being influential, like they're your peers now, you know what I mean? You can sit and hang out with Horacio or Glenn Cochi or Matt or any of the guys. Cause, and they look at you as an equal, like you're a guy on the scene. That's great.
It's crazy to even think about that too. You know what I mean? It's like, even like, you know, that scene, you know, even in Nashville, like I was talking about having, you know, breakfast with Eddie Bears or hanging out with Near Z or those guys. It's like, I remember just being a kid, just seeing them in Modern Drummer, you know, and like Milton Sledge and all those guys. I was like, man, I want to be like these guys, you know? And then all of a sudden, like, they're your Facebook friends. You follow each other on Instagram. You text every now and then.
Yeah.
You go to Drum Paradise and there's Eddie and whoever, you know, going through their stuff, you know. Becoming friends with Chris McHugh is hilarious and fun. And, you know, it's just kind of, you know, it's just, it's interesting because, like, you never thought I never thought I would see myself there. I should say this. I thought I said I'd see myself as hopefully being successful at something. But I never thought in a million years that, like, I could call Eddie Bears and not talk about drums. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or I could call, you know, Ben Caesar and we can talk about some, you know, the most random shit in the world, you know?
Yeah.
Or, like, yeah. I have a text message thread with Lester Stell, Marcus, Stephen Keith, Derek Phillips, and Hubert Payne. And we talk every day about nothing.
Yeah. That's great, man.
And everything at the same time. You know, I have a couple of those. I've met them with Ben and Kevin Murphy and a bunch of guys also that we have, you know, but it's just fun that, you know, you can that to be in the know with all those great people. You know what I mean? It's like, it's cool because you're like, man, like, these are my, like, first of all, they're my friends. I don't care about what their status in the world, but they're my friends. And then sometimes you just pinch yourself. You're like, man, I'm friends with Lester Stell. Or I just got a text message from Booker T. Jones. Like, what?
Man, you know
what I mean? You know what I mean? It's like just things like that are just kind of goofy to me because I tell people when I wake up every morning, I'm still like this 18-year-old kid that's like hungry and ready to, you know, to like take on the world to some degree. And then I get up and I'm like, oh my God, I'm 43 and my back hurts. But it's just so interesting to me that like, I made it to a point. I made it to a spot that I never thought I'd be in my life. And I'm very happy for it. And I'm super, super thankful for all of my friendships with everybody that I have, you know, in the business, you know, not in the business, you know, got a great kid. She's like 17. All these fun things. It's like, you know, it's like one of those things where it's like, it's hard to be negative when you have a lot of great things, even though sometimes I get pretty dark and want to smash shit. But, for the most part,
we all do. Yeah. No, but you know, it's nice to hear you say that you're thankful for all these, you know, like you know, you've got a great life and you've got all these great people in your life. And you're thankful, and that shows. You know what I mean? You ooze this positive energy whenever I see you. You're laughing, and you're making people laugh. You're always making people laugh. So
I like doing it. It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah, and your playing doesn't make people laugh. I just want to make sure you know that your playing does not make my
well. I don't
my
know. It playing, depends on the day.
My playing makes people laugh.
It depends on the day. I just, so this is so funny. You laugh about this. And this is one of those fun moments. So I put a gig yesterday with some friends and it was all original music for the most part that my buddy Sam has. And they called me last minute and they're like, hey man, can you do it? It's like 13 songs. I was like, yeah. Well, I've been on this whole kick lately of putting my ride cymbal like here. So like basically playing open handed, but I'm not playing open handed. So it's more like the Bernard Purdy thing.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I have the ride cymbal here, But I like it because I can play it with both hands. So like if I want to, if I have to play like a tom thing, I like it because I can play ride cymbal and then play the tom thing like this, as opposed to doing this and crossing over my body, which may have shown or not. But anyway, and so I show up, I put the ride cymbal right there, do a thing, and then we do I Feel Fine by the Beatles. And, you know, it has that same that same pattern as like the Ray Charles tune. And I haven't crossed my hands and played that yet. So I'm going, I just started laughing at myself. So then I was like, hey, dumbass, there's another symbol right here. Just move your hand over. I go, cool. So I go there and I'm like, all right. I'm not doing this very well. And I made it back over here.
Oh, at least your shoulder. Yeah, if you're playing it that way though, I gotta think your shoulder's gonna like at a point go, ah. Yeah.
Oh, I was laughing because I'm not at the point where I can play that pattern with my left hand on the ride cymbal. So I had to pull up my right and I'm just like, oh no.
Yeah, that's a hard pattern, man. That's a hard the way he plays it.
It was hard, I was like, I mean, it was cool, and I had the best part is I had a lot of fun, and the rest of the band was laughing at me at while because I was also laughing. And after the gig, I was like, I gave one of those. I was like, you know what? No one should play Beatles songs except for the Beatles.
Right. Right on. Yeah.
If it's not come together, I don't want to play it. So that's a fun moment of people laughing at my playing, and it was mostly me laughing at it. But
that's fair enough. But man, this has been so great. I thank you so much for being here today with me. This has been would be informative, and I knew we'd have tons of laughs along the way. So,
yeah, I like to laugh. Laughing is a key to life, man. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like. During the pandemic, I started this whole thing where I would wake up and the first thing I did was I would find some sort of comedy thing on YouTube or something. And I would watch it like 15 minutes. So the first thing I did was I just laughed first thing in the morning.
That's great.
And it just totally set the pace of the day. Cause I, you know, at that time we're all like, you know, doing our thing and everybody's kind of losing their minds a little bit. But I started my day off laughing and it was awesome. And then every now and then throughout the day, I would just put on some different little comedy bits or listen to music or whatever. And it just kept me going. It kind of kept me going through that year. And I was like, you know, this is a good thing. I'm going to keep doing it. So I still do it. I wake up in the morning is I just watch. I don't even look at my text messages or missed calls. I just like go and find something funny, like comedy, blah, blah, blah. Just type. And I sit there and I have a good laugh. I have a chuckle. And then my body cracks as I get out of bed. And then I start my day, and it's great.
Yeah. No, that's I like that. That is. That's really, really smart. That's good advice.
It can help set the pace for the day because, as we all know, during the day, people can challenge you. So
yeah.
So I'm honored. I'm honored to be here. So thank you very much.
You got it. Well, we'll end the stream. Hang with me for 1 second. I want to thank everybody for watching. Thanks, everybody. Big hand for Keo Stroud. Hey, everybody. John DeChristopher here, and I want to thank you for watching and listening to Live from My Drum Room. I started this show in April of 2020, and it's now 4 years and almost 200 episodes later, and I'm excited to tell you about my new Live from My Drum Room t-shirts. In fact, I'm wearing one right now. Made of 60% cotton, 40% polyester, a really soft cotton blend. I'm wearing a size medium, and you can have yours for $25, including shipping, in the contiguous U.S. I will give you my Venmo information, which I'll also include in the description. There's my Venmo information, and you can email me at livefrommydrumroom@gmail.com with any questions, and that will also be in the description. So get your shirt while they last. They're available in extra small to double XL. I do have limited quantities of the extra smalls and the double XLs, but plenty of everything else. So once again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. And don't forget to pick up your Live from My Drum Room t-shirt. See you soon. And remember, no drummers are harmed on any show. All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you again real soon. See ya.